Patricia Lanoux.
Yeah.
You said narcissism was transformed with Job.
Yeah.
We've read a lot about narcissism, particularly with regard to the person you've mentioned. And at least what I've read, there's not much therapy or medical help available. Would you give your opinion?
I think that it is possible to treat narcissistic character disorders psychotherapeutically, but it takes a long time. But most of them won't come for treatment because they are people who make other people suffer, and they're not in touch with their own suffering. But the ones that do come are usually forced into it by a spouse. And I think they can be helped, although I think it's quite difficult. The exception is the psychopath. The true malignant narcissistic psychopath are almost untreatable. And the difficulty that we have is that these are people who, when they're not criminal, get into positions of power in any profession that requires control over other people, because that's what they seek, because that makes them feel safe. So they're in the military, they're in the police force, they're in business. Many of the CEOs of major corporations are psychopaths. You know the old saying that life is like soup, the scum and the cream come to the top. They get themselves in position of power because it makes them feel safe. So in any line of work where you need power over other people, you find psychopaths, I'm afraid. I don't know if that's... So they are very difficult to treat, but they don't usually want treatment. They think everybody else is the problem. Yeah.
And that they're doing fine.
They're doing fine, yeah.
My question has to do with an example you gave early in your talk today where you, I think it was a clinical example of a person you were working with who had narcissistic rage and who was very tuned into your, I guess,
to my behavior, my facial expressions and everything. Yeah.
Right, and you talked about kind getting to forgiveness and how this person understood that that was therapeutic. My question has to do with, I'd like to know more about how you negotiate the need for the patient to express forgiveness. I'm thinking of a lot of the psychoanalytic examples where the way the case examples are written, it sounds like it's a long process during which it's a reparenting, and there are more. There are some therapeutic approaches where the therapist might say, you know, I'm afraid you're going to burn me out if you keep attacking me the way you're attacking me.
Yeah.
And so I want to be able to work with you. And
so
I'm curious about what your approach
is. Well, I'm in favor of an approach called the disruption repair cycle. What happens is, I mean, in all relationships, you make a connection, and then sometimes something happens that disrupts the connection. One person does something that hurts or offends the other. And so the relationship is disrupted. And when you have a relationship, an important relationship is disrupted, you feel usually either anger or hurt or withdrawal, or you get paranoid or something like that. Something happens. So in the therapeutic situation, when the relationship's been going along reasonably well, and then the therapist does something that disrupts the connection, you immediately will see, maybe immediately or maybe within a few days or weeks, you see a reaction on the part of the client or the patient, and you realize something has gone wrong, and you try to unpack what went wrong. When I said that, I hurt your feelings because, you know, and you try and explain what happened. And you hope that what you don't do is what happened to them in childhood, where when they had a disruption with a parent, the parent just said, you know, go to your room and don't come out till you agree with me. That's the kind of thing that causes further trauma. But in a therapeutic situation, you can actually analyze what each of us said that was hurtful. And that's called the repair cycle. So you have a disruption repair. And then if you can repair it adequately, and then this is true in all relationships, it actually deepens the relationship. The connection gets stronger. If you can't repair it, the person will leave therapy. And it's a very common reason for people to leave therapy is that they've been hurt in some way and it was never repaired. And you get this with parents and children all the time. You get this disruption and repair. And with reasonable parents, the repair makes up for what went wrong. But if it's never repaired, then it just becomes a deep-seated trauma in the individual. So.
Lionel, I'm impressed with your ability to talk in such a calm manner.
I'm glad you think I'm calm.
If one isn't depressed, then there is the danger of the aggression coming out. And so you've obviously been able to find that balance. And as a physician, I'm projecting that your state of homeostasis is such that the brain has found an intellectual container for something else that is usually on a reactive level, impulsive, not unsimilar to the impulse for life that our predators had for thousands of years. In order to survive, you've got to do what's necessary. And somewhere along the line, the necessity for survival requires a certain force.
Yeah.
And I remember an English teacher saying, the role of the dentist is to find out how to leverage the effect of force. Now, your personality is so gentle, I don't see... Whereas I get to a point where when I'm dealing with an addict, I've got to raise my voice and I've got to tell them, shit or get off the pot, these are the laws, you've got to change something, right? And so there's something about an addictive path in the brain that makes it very difficult for the client to be able to make that switch.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know you're talking about it, two previous questions touched on just how do you not keep a narcissist in treatment too long that you are giving him some secondary gain for being there because he's a good paying client.
Well, that would be the therapist's shadow, wouldn't it? Yes. You better stay in therapy because I want to recarpet the living room. Yeah. But you're talking about the necessity to set limits. Sometimes you have to set firm limits. And I guess if I don't work with many addicts, but if you work, maybe that's necessary when you work with addicts. I would defer to your experience of that. Where am I? Mauro, did you want to? Oh, sorry.
Well, to continue the discussion of narcissism, I found it shocking that you said that many CEOs of business are psychopaths, but I don't want to talk about psychopaths. My name is Judy Hubbard. I live in Washington, D.C., and we have a lot of big, big egos. And I would just like your opinion on, we've talked about bad politicians. What are the kind of traits for a good politician? And what does it take to be? It takes an enormous ego to be a politician.
Yeah.
And I am actually, amazed at anybody who would ever want to be a politician and
share
go
your
through
amazement.
That excruciating daily humiliation.
Yeah.
So if you would just talk about politics, and this would also be actors and actresses as well. You have to, have such a strong personality to be able to...
To not be corrupted.
Especially, we are in need of a good politician in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And are there any around? What kind of personality?
We have had very few really emotionally healthy presidents. If you think about the people we've had, most of them have had quite severe personality disorders. Gerald Ford wasn't too bad, but he got there by accident. Carter wasn't a psychopath, but he didn't do very well. But he, most of the presidents we've had have been pretty grandiose and arrogant. But
Obama.
Well, I'm going to get into very hot water here. I think your point is correct that you have to have, you have to have some wish to have power. And I would always question the need to have power over other people. Let me put it politely like that. It has to be tempered by the wish to be of service. Mm-hmm. And that I think the intensity of that wish must be the factor which makes the difference. Some people are just self-serving, aren't they? Yeah, but they must all share the need for power. And maybe that comes out of a vulnerability or the sense of something missing.
Yeah. And maybe we've rewritten history because we had the founding fathers that seemed, you know, we've raised them to some sort of elevation of superpower.
Yeah.
But maybe the one president that I think of that might have had balanced the power plus good would be George Washington. But maybe that's just, you know, a myth. Maybe it's just a historical myth. But anyway, I would love to continue this discussion about good politicians.
Yeah, the difficulty is that, you know, we only see them from the outside. We don't know what their inner world is like. And they have idealized biographies that don't really tell us much. So I don't feel very confident talking about this, to be perfectly honest. Thank you, anyway. I share your anxiety about the problem. 4% of the population is supposed to be psychopathic. That's incredible. If that was the latest survey that I saw. I read a 4%. Yeah, I forgot the name of it. It was a woman researcher. I can't remember her name. 4%. That's horrendous. Yeah. Yeah.
Hi, Mara's my name. You've been talking about childhood experiences where you have abusive parents and whatever. Children have negative experiences in their life. And then somehow it gets internalized. And then the voice that is the parent's voice becomes your own voice.
Yeah.
And the question is that inner tyrant,
yeah.
That inner killer or whatever. And I struggle with, do I try to tame this inner voice or tyrant or kill it? Like in The Wizard of Oz, where the house falls on the witch and be done.
Yeah.
And so I know this is a big topic, but if you could just speak
You have to try and soften it. The technical term for it is a punitive superego. If you have harsh, punitive parents, their voice is living on inside you, as it were, attacking you from the inside, constantly telling you that you're not good enough, or not smart enough, or not whatever it is enough. So that predisposes to a kind of chronic depression because you never feel adequate. The way you deal with that, at least therapeutically, is by trying to soften. I remember a woman recently said to me, I was at my sister's wedding and I was enormously ashamed of myself. I hated myself because I was envious of her because she was getting married and I'm not married. How could I be envious and hate my own sister? So there's the inner tyrant attacking her for being envious. So there's no point in saying to someone like that, yes, you wicked thing, stop it. Okay? or don't worry, you'll get married soon. You know, something like that. Or give up and go to a convent. Or, you know, those things would be suggestions at the level of the ego. So what I said to her was, join the human race. It's understandable to be envious in a situation like that. That was just my attempt to normalize and soften the inner critic. And I found that's really the only way that you can deal with it. You can't do it by supporting the ego. You have to do it by depotentiating the emotional intensity of the critic. Is that okay? That's the best I can do in a short time. 4 minutes to. Oh, more questions? Don't make it a difficult one. I only have 4 minutes.
I'll try to keep it simple. Thank you so much. A lot of empowering concepts, at least for me. I've grabbed a number of things that I will take with me. Many questions, so I've selected only a few to...
only a few?
I have too many, so I'll boil it down to a few things. So
pick the best, pick the one only, that's...
Okay. You talked about reservoir of rage and tapping into it.
Yeah.
I would think if where does this rage reside? I would think it's in the body.
Yes.
And if it is possible to tap into it, is it possible to use it for, repurpose it, or actually bring compassion to it, rather than allowing it to go through cycles?
Yes.
And not to leave the other question, because I find it very important for me, is once you gain connection to your shadow, or with the concept of creating a God that has a shadow, what is the ultimate goal?
Wait, did you say creating a God out of
a new concept of God? You mentioned about a God that has a shadow rather than only good.
Uh-huh.
What is the ultimate goal? What do we see? What would we find if we live?
Well, the Jungian theory gets a little esoteric. I didn't have time to go into this, but the idea is that the self or the divine incarnates a fragment of itself into the empirical human personality, okay? So that when, I might just need a few minutes to deal with this, I'm sorry. It's deep in the weeds of Jungian theory. I don't know if I can put it into a short paragraph. But when you're born, there's the self, the God image, gives a kind of blueprint for the unfolding of the personality. That's what they mean when they say the self is the archetypal basis of the ego. Now, the way it does that is it gives you a set of spiritual potentials which are present at birth, which gradually embody themselves as you go through life. So you might be born with the potentials to be an artist or a musician or something. So those potentials then have to be lived out in the body. Now, some of those potentials are going to be your potential for evil and shadow. But because they come from the self, they are the incarnate fragment of a fraction of the dark side of the self. When you work to redeem that aspect of yourself, you are actually helping to transform the divine shadow by working on it in yourself. That's Jung's notion. And in that sense, the working on evil has a redemptive quality, not just for the individual, but also for the divine. That'll be $5.
Thank you. Thank you. That was really good.